up your morning light and say a little prayer for I. You know that if we are to stay alive and see the peace in every eye.
My name is Chris Jordan, and welcome to the first episode of The Soundtrack to My Life. The soundtrack in this particular episode is dedicated to a part of my life story, and it was quite a big part, and has been, should I say, over the past 25 years or so. Today, the colorful, pun intended, road to facing more than just a sexual orientation. We live in a world that is just, it's drowning in labels, and a lot of people really kind of act quite aggressively towards that. I get that. I do understand that with the label comes a lot of presumptions and assumptions, but in a lot of cases, hate becomes a very big norm. I do use the fact that labels are good in terms of what we seek most in this life, which is self-actualization, and they are bad for all those reasons I just mentioned above. If I look back, this is what the series is about. It's about looking back and, you know, just channeling the soundtrack of what was happening in my life at that particular point or particular points, and really just remembering how it felt, you know, get some clarity on that whole entire journey, thoughts, feelings, actions, emotions, spiritual connections or lack of. I can look back and I can safely and genuinely say that I do not regret anything. Not because I'm this fabulous human being that has kind of conquered that, but I genuinely believe and act in today, and mostly because today has so many problems that I have no capacity for really dwelling on the past. And so I like to always think about the past with introspection and retrospection, I suppose. Never forget what today means because of what happened. Now, before I say anything more, this is not some victimized, crucified martyrdom. It's a story. It's mine personally. And I know that a lot of people would relate to the narrative. In fact, I've got some great people that have decided to also share their journey with you. It was very rough. No martyrdom implied. Because as I move on, you'll understand why I made it as rough as it could be. And they always say, aren't the best journeys the really rough ones? It's such a cliche. And people don't see it, and I don't believe it while it's happening. You know, it is a cliche, and it wouldn't be one if it wasn't true. I'm 40 now. I'm proudly and so easily happy with being who I am and being a gay man. It's not even a thought. But again, not trivialize the boy at 15 years old that was watching Dawson's Creek. There was this character. His name was Jack, very good looking man. And this particular character, I mean, I did not see it coming. It was great. It was great storytelling. It was wonderful. But when this man just broke down in one episode, you know, was fighting with his parents and, you know, there was pressure and whatever it may have been. And boom, out came the secret. Opened the closet, blasted out. And I seem to know this guy. I understand that when we are going through certain phases in our life and we're growing up and we are kind of identifying, especially within our teen years, some people have more clarity than others. Back in the early 90s, and especially within my family and friend circle, like, I didn't have anyone to speak to while I was feeling uncomfortable, except God. And I do remember this one thing, that when these genuinely uncomfortable feelings that I would, you know, I would, I would identify as, I suppose, kind of, what's the right word? Some kind of compliment, you know, so I would compliment in my own mind men that were good looking. as it grew a little bit stronger, my prayers became a lot more desperate. And it came right down to the point where there was nothing else I was praying for at night. I just kept saying, God, I know I love you. That'll never change. You always answer whatever need and prayer that I have, and I pray that this will go away. And that prayer just happened on and on and on and on for what must have been years, must have been a good couple of years. But nothing changed. And I want to say nothing changed because nothing was wrong. But I didn't see it like that back then.
Hendrik, this is my coming out story, or my not coming out story. I never officially came out to my family. The only person that I really felt the need to discuss this issue with was my grandmother, whom I was very close to. So when I was in university, probably first or second year, I can't remember, I had time with my grandmother and I explained to her that I was different from usual men and that I preferred other men. And she was very confused by it. She didn't really understand it. And I had to explain it in terms of Werner Fels, the creator of Lieverhexe, that she was very familiar with, and said, well, you know, Werner is also one of us. So that's the only person I honestly came out to at a very late stage in my life. I never felt the need to come out, specifically not to my father. My father was a little bit of a racist and a homophobe. Very nice man, all in all. But I never felt the need to discuss this with him. And I know that they knew. My mother passed away when I was young, so I had a stepmother. And I remember one day I told them, also at varsity, at first year, I think, or second year, whenever, I told them I had something important to tell them. And they looked very distressed and called me to the room. And then I told them that I was a smoker. And they seemed very relieved. So I'm sure they expected me to tell them that I was gay, but I never did. I've just lived my life the way I've seen fit. I have brought boyfriends home once in a while. They knew the people I was involved with. I was also married to a woman for a number of years, and that took them by surprise, if anything. And when we eventually got divorced, I did tell my in-laws that the reason why we got divorced was because I was gay, and, you know, relationship, the romantic relationship didn't work out, but our friendship still as strong as ever. So I never felt the need to come out officially. I've done many public things, which, you know, nobody can doubt that I'm gay. I also am never making a secret of the fact that I do see men. I'm not in a fixed relationship at the moment, but I used to see a young guy for 8 years, and everybody knew about him. I also have a lesbian sister. She did the rounds to all the family and officially told everybody. I never felt that need. So yeah, this is my non-coming out story. Living my life the way I please and not really caring what other people think. Some of my family don't really speak to me. I'm not sure whether it's because I'm gay and openly gay and I've done all these things that are in the public domain, such as the whole campaign against Stephen Anderson, or being involved in the first gay flag raising at Pretoria City Hall, or, you know, being involved in a gay radio station. All those things certainly speaks louder than words, actions, aren't they? So, yeah, that's my story. I hope you can take something from it.
Jumped to my early 20s, and I found a gay utopia. It was about an hour out from where I stayed, and I still stayed with my parents in my very early 20s. It was supposedly far enough where no one would recognize me. I would go to this particular area alone, because who am I going to share these experiences with? We are deeply, deeply, deeply still in the closet. I actually, you know what, it's laughable now, but it was traumatic back then. I would actually say whatever feelings and whatever emotions or whatever attraction I would have, that could stay to the weekend. And from Monday to Friday, I would be, I might as well have been straight. But I was desperate. You must understand, a desperate animal will look for any desperate measures to console that they are supposed to face and are not. But when I put on my gay hat, you know, the obvious gay metaphor, it was one that I was totally ashamed of. It was sometimes rather seedy, which is kind of normal within our culture. Sometimes it was blinding. Sometimes it was like a scene out of some drug-induced electro heaven, more like a hell. But of course, it was also lit with the same dangers as any other retro party scene would have been drowned with. Guys spiking your drinks just to have you suited up for whatever they felt like. Guys left passed out in the parking lots or roaming the empty streets in a daze trying to make sense of what just happened to them. And you go home and the normalcy is actually hellish. Well, as you step back into the closet, you live the week and you become an emptier and an emptier and just an empty, completely empty shell.
Hello everyone, my name is Ditsakho, and I am a journalist, a writer, a broadcaster, a presenter, and I also happen to be a transgender woman. I always mention that last because I'm just trying to drum it into people's heads that it's not the most important thing about me. I don't even think it's the most interesting thing about me, but people do believe it is, or people make it so. So for political reasons and for all intents and purposes, especially for the purpose of this podcast, that is a very important part of who I am, and that is what we'll be discussing. So I've always told people that I don't have a coming out story, because I've always been a very flamboyant child. I've always been very over the top. I mean, my family was quite modern. All of us went to Model C schools, but we were still a black family, and we still had traditional values. But more than traditional values, I come from a very Christian family with a very religious background and guideline. For the longest time, or from the beginning of time, at least my time, I identified as a gay boy, and I've never had to come out to my family. In the African culture, we have very clear, defined gender roles. There isn't a blend. There is no gray area. Men do certain things and men behave certain ways, and girls do certain things and girls behave a certain way, and there are certain expectations set upon the different genders. And in the African culture, we only acknowledge two genders. You know, unlike the Indian culture or the Samoan culture or even the Mexican culture, where some of them acknowledge up to five different genders, you know. Because I'm black, it was immediately obvious that this child is not behaving in the way that a male person or a person assigned male or a person born with a penis is supposed to behave. That was always very clear. But I was so blessed to be born from my family or born of my family, because even though that fact was made known to me, it wasn't, I was made aware that I'm different, but I was never made aware that I was less than what everyone else is. And it turned out to be very right. It turned out to be more than right, actually, because not only were they never going to get a makoti, but I turned out that I was going to be someone else's makoti, because I didn't know there was another layer, there was another thing I could be in addition, or not even in addition, but there were other sexual orientations and gender expressions that I could possibly fall under. Yes, I didn't know that. And I've always known I was a girl. I've always behaved like a girl. Even when I identified as gay, I was the girliest in my groups, and even my gay friends would tease me. It would be an inside joke about how, like, I'm gayer than gay. Like, I'm a new shade of pink that is yet to be discovered. It was only when I moved to the States to complete my master's degree that I was Dorothy in the Wizard of Oz. I was making new discoveries about the world, and most importantly about myself. And it was only when I lived in New York that I got a proper sort of definition of what a transgender person is. And not only that, but how much it resonated with me, and it was almost like a light bulb going on. But it was not something that was hidden. I've never had to sit my family down and say, "Mom, Dad, I have something to tell you." It was who I was. I behaved that way, and they sort of they immediately, instinctively accepted and supported me. It's almost as if I didn't give them a choice in the matter. You know? And that's what I did also with my transness. I came back from the States, having lived my best woman life, ready to take my skills and my qualifications and change the world and leave a mark. And a lot of people were very happy for me. You know, I have people who said to me, "About damn time," you know. And I've had people who I looked up to as mentors, who've known me from a very young age and who have seen me grow, and they have come up to me and said, like, "This makes so much sense to me. I get this. And you look happy. You look complete. You look content." I don't know if that counts as a coming out story. But yeah, that's me. That's my journey with regards to my transitioning and accepting who and what I am. And I'm still transitioning now, and I don't know what changes are still to come about, but I am mentally ready, I am physically ready. They've just recently doubled my dose, which I didn't, because initially when I started the pills, and they warn you about this, you become an emotional wreck. You are a mess. You really do become a mess, hey? But as time goes on, like a horse, you get a handle on the reins and you get control over the beast. My body is responding so positively. The changes are visible. They're tangible. They're juicy. Like I said, I can't say this enough. I'm loving the woman I am, you know. And like I said, I hope I'm not coming across as someone who's living a perfect life. Not by any stretch of the imagination. But I do really try my best. I go out of my way to be happy. I don't just let it happen. I don't leave it to chance. I try consciously be happy, which is for me the most important thing.
I was just, I just turned 30. That's only been 10 years ago when I officially came out. And for me, and I understand for you, it's coming out, quote unquote, is basically defining that moment where you come out to the people that you really, really, really care about. For me, that was my parents. I was, by that time, I was totally lost. And I don't want to, again, I don't want to trivialize that. I was lost and I was gone. And that was years and years of this moonlighted life and the resentment for myself. But that resentment for them, for my parents, for assuming that they would hate me for being me. As the cliche says, that assumption and that fear and loathing in Las Vegas, so to speak, is just one of those things. It's born out of complete crippling fear for what you might lose.
And dream over me with a tear. Anything it takes to wish me. Oh, magic and sweet lullabies. Any lucky penny will do fine. Oh, to wish me here.
Why is it so difficult to look in the mirror and not be your own worst enemy? People are killing themselves. And we say that like it's statistical nature. It's so much of the norm. But if you have some sort of empathetic nature in you, you'd put yourself in someone that is suffering. You'd put yourself in their shoes. And you just understand why a statistic is not exactly that. Why it's so much more than just a number, creed, race, color, whatever it may be, doesn't matter. Just a little bit of empathy. If someone has to tell you their story and you listen and you feel and you react and you give of yourself, I feel like that is an exact narrative for what we should be telling ourselves. As we have that enemy status to ourselves, we know we all do it. We know that some people do it more than others. Sometimes more so than we'd like to actually face and realize and admit to. I suppose it's human nature, but it's also human nature to celebrate the pitfalls of another. It's human nature to berate another, to hate another, but it's also human nature to love, to live and to live on. This equality thing in 2021 is a joke. It's a joke. It's like we've come so far through all the battles, our own and I would say as a civilization, to land up in a place that has the worst amount of liberal intolerance. How far do we have to run from that part of ourselves that's pure, that's untouched, that's unscathed, that's you and that's me? You know when you're born and there's that true, so it's the true Chris, it's right there, it's wonderful, and we keep shielding it. The older we get and the more trauma we go through and the more feelings that we have and the more self-identity we seem to think we are losing, we shelter and shelter and shelter that little voice that was the best version of us. From every morning we wake up, we get back to business, whether it's holding the weight of the world on your shoulders or it is falling in line to make sure that you don't stand out, that humanity doesn't notice what makes you different. I urge you to stop and don't do that. Every little bit of progress counts. And every extra second that you do spend in front of the mirror, literally, and secure yourself a small percent of that pure, untouched, beautiful part of self, will add lifetimes of gold and silver to your day ahead. For me, I want to thank that soundtrack to my life. That constant reminder from Dawson's Creek that I don't want to go, that I don't want to wait, that life is a bitch, but any lucky penny will do. #OneLove. I don't want to